From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, student walkouts, racist graffiti in a high school bathroom, an attack on a pro-Donald Trump student at Woodside High School, and a Mountain View history teacher who was placed on leave for drawing parallels between Trump and Hitler. Bay Area schools are grappling with post-election anxiety and conflict. We'll discuss how students, teachers, and administrators are navigating the turbulent times and trying to foster understanding and civil conversation in the aftermath of a divisive election. That's next on Forum. Join us after this news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Schools throughout the Bay Area have been grappling with a range of emotions among their students after the election of Donald Trump as president, from anger or fear over the president-elect's campaign rhetoric to deport all undocumented immigrants, to pro-Trump students feeling silenced. Meantime, administrators are also dealing with an apparent surge of racist incidents, including reports that the words white and colored were scrawled on the bathroom wall of a Danville high school. In this hour of Forum, we'll look at what schools, both here and nationwide, are experiencing and their efforts to foster dialogue in this anxious post-election environment. I'm joined now by Chris Funk. He's superintendent of Eastside Union High School, where a district teacher at Oak Grove Union High School is on paid leave for reportedly telling a student who refused to stand for the national anthem that he'd be deported. Chris Funk, good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm well. Thanks for joining us. What can you tell us about this incident?
Well, it's certainly an unfortunate situation that took place during a rally where the national anthem was being played, and a few students were using their constitutional right to not participate, and they were just sitting during the national anthem, not making any noise or disturbance, and unfortunately, a teacher made an inappropriate remark to them for not participating.
NBC Bay Area reported that as being good luck with being deported now that Donald Trump is president. Is that what the teacher said?
Something to that effect. We're currently investigating the situation and interviewing individuals to confirm what was actually said.
And then if it's found that that was said, what could the teacher face?
A range from a letter of reprimand to unpaid leave.
How are the students handling that? There was a student who was also quoted in the NBC Bay Area story as saying that they were shocked because they never thought they'd hear that coming from a teacher. Are you addressing how students are feeling about that publicized incident?
Well, from the time of the end of the election, we knew that students needed to be able to process the outcome of the election. And as you know, through social media and across the nation, students are trying to find ways to deal with their emotions. And so we sent out a letter to all of our stakeholders, our parents, students, and teachers, reminding them of their responsibility as educators to make sure that we maintain a safe environment, as well as being able to allow our students the opportunity to process their feelings of the election results. And that could be in different forums. It could be at a rally. It could be in the quad in an open mic situation. It could be allowing them to simply gather and do a march. One school had a march around the actual school, and then 20 minutes later, they were back in the classroom. So we're trying to handle it based on the uniqueness of each community and each high school, but we're not there to promote. We're there to help facilitate and provide an opportunity for kids to process their feelings.
And protests, they're not being sanctioned by the district or the schools, correct?
Absolutely not. We are encouraging them to protest, in the right way, and just simply walking out of classroom and leaving the campus with no intent or no goal or no destination is a disruption. So we're encouraging that if they feel the need to have some type of protest, that we're creating the space for that to happen where they can remain safe.
Are you, so students who do leave campus for protests, are they getting unexcused absences as they are in some other districts?
Yeah, if they're leaving the campus and not returning, it is an unexcused absence.
But are they, and I guess the question I have too is a spokesman for Oakland Unified School District said that on Monday, that Monday would basically be the final day for leniency for skipping class. I mean, is there disciplinary action other than an unexcused absence on students who leave to protest in your district?
We haven't had to reach that point yet. My feeling is that it's not a one-day opportunity to voice your opinion. It's an ongoing process. That's what democracy is, and that's what education is all about. But there's a right way and a wrong way. And if you're going to choose to leave school, it's an unexcused absence. So when you build those unexcused absences up, there are consequences to that. But we're trying to encourage, and what we've seen on our campuses is students have been respectful of the way we've set up the opportunities for them to speak out, and we have not seen kids leaving school in masses. It's a handful of kids here and there.
How are you encouraging teachers to facilitate safe conversations for students of different political leanings?
You know, the way we have established that is very similar to my letter that I sent out to the entire community welcoming them back to school in August. With all of the issues that happened this summer with the police shootings, Black Lives Matter movement, with all the terror that took place here in the United States and internationally, that students are going to want to talk about that, and that we need to provide that opportunity in our classrooms. As long as we're not advocating one strong viewpoint over the other, we have to allow both sides to be discussed. And so some teachers feel confidence in having that conversation, and others continue on with their normal curriculum. So we just want to make sure, whether it's in the classroom or it's in clubs, there's an opportunity in some place on the campus where kids can express their feelings in a safe environment.
But do you feel like, you know, that you're sort of finding your way in terms of the correct tools, or do you have sort of a standard curriculum or policy that you're able to give to teachers about how to do this?
No, that's probably an area that we can certainly improve on, to have a standard curriculum. But I don't think there's anything standard, because each event is its own unique situation. So I think the protocols are very clear that it's one thing to, if a student asks you a straight-up question, are you a Democrat or a Republican, or did you vote for Trump or Clinton, to say, yes, I voted for that. But to advocate for their position and then not allow the other side to be heard, that is not a neutral teacher. That's not someone that's facilitating the conversation. And so those basically are the criteria that we put forward. And quite frankly, our teachers have been very professional about this, other than this one episode.
In your letter that you posted on the district website, you also noted that 90% of the school's funding comes from the state, and that the president has no authority over your school and how it's run. Why did you feel the need to include that?
Well, because in our school district and across the California and the nation, we have a lot of undocumented students. And in the United States, every student has a right to a free public education, regardless of whether they're a citizen or not, or undocumented or not, regardless of their religion, regardless of their ethnicity. And I just wanted to reassure our students that the federal government is not going to be coming onto our campuses. ICE agents are not going to be coming onto our campuses and hunting kids down, that they're going to be safe and they're going to be protected, and they have a right to a free and public education.
Well, Chris Funk, thank you for talking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for hosting the forum.
Chris Funk, superintendent of Eastside Union High School District, where a district teacher is on leave pending an investigation for alleged racism. Let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. With me is Emily Dury. She is senior associate editor covering education at The Atlantic. Good morning, Emily Dury.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. And thanks also to David Morin. He is Bay Area executive director of the group Generation Citizen, which works to provide youth with action civics education to enable them to participate in American democracy. And David, if I could start with you, you know, this incident that I was talking with the superintendent about involved a gym teacher allegedly saying to a student that he would be deported. And In your organization, you work with some 1,500 students, is that right, that may be undocumented or are immigrants?
That's correct. We are working in about 27 schools throughout San Francisco, Berkeley, and Oakland, and 8,000 plus across the country. And many of those students are undocumented.
And what are you hearing them say after the election?
Well, I think the thing that everyone would expect is that there's really palpable fear among many of our students, especially those who face, you know, very tangible consequences with the recent election. So I think a lot of our students are facing those consequences with a lot of trepidation. And right now, there's not a lot of answers to be able to provide them.
And so the fear, you mean that they will be deported?
That's right. I think the teachers don't have a strong enough grasp on what the implications are. And I don't know that there's anybody out there that can give definitive answers to.
So you're really feeling like schools don't have a clear sense of how to handle this right now.
I think that's right. I mean, I think there's just this caught the country by surprise in many ways. And I think teachers are left kind of figuring out how best to address the situation.
And Emily Dury, give us a picture of the national situation. Now, post-election, you've interviewed close to, you know, 40 teachers or so and counselors in schools across the country, including here in the Bay Area. And I was wondering if you could share with us some of the things that you heard students say and do, especially immediately after Election Day, to teachers.
Sure. We are hearing from students who are scared that they're going to be deported. We spoke with a teacher who said that a young African-American student asked whether slavery was going to be brought back. There was a first grader in Philadelphia who asked his teacher if Trump was going to blow everyone up. And these are sort of extreme reactions, but I think that kids really lack context for processing the election results. And I agree that teachers and the adults around them are struggling to provide that because it's not clear yet sort of what policies are actually going to be enacted. But I think that that's something teachers are trying to clarify, is to provide some history, to provide some lessons about checks and balances, for instance, and about what Trump can and cannot do.
And how quickly certain, you know, policy or even campaign rhetoric suggestions could be implemented.
Exactly.
And you also had some statistics in the piece that you wrote for The Atlantic about how schools are dealing with this nationwide, where 80% of public school teachers are white and vast majority are female, which you probably already know. But the other statistic that was interesting is that 1 in 5 identifies as a Republican. So it skews heavily Democratic.
Right, it does. There aren't nearly as many Republican teachers as Democratic teachers. And so I think you have teachers grappling with their own personal views about the election and trying to remain somewhat neutral and then striking that balance between supporting students, many of them of color, who are scared that their families are going to be deported or, for instance, that slavery is going to be brought back, with trying to support kids who may come from families that supported Trump and not ostracizing those children. And it's a hard balance to strike. And some teachers are being forthcoming about their views about the election with students, but then there are others who are trying to remain very, very fact-based. And it really...
Yes, please, continue.
It really varied by location. I spoke with an instructor in Kentucky, and she said that about... you know, her students were pretty evenly divided between supporting Trump and Clinton, and she was trying to facilitate some dialogue between them and remain very neutral. Speaking with teachers in San Francisco, most students seemed to support Clinton, and there was a lot more trying to reassure students that they would be safe. So it really varied.
What kinds of curriculum are teachers using to try to address the election? It sounded like they're kind of trying to invent it a little bit.
Right. I think that's definitely fair. I don't think that there is any sort of clear guideline for how to approach something like this. And teachers are sort of turning to what they know. So I spoke with an English teacher who had her students reading certain poetry and comparing it to the election. There was a science teacher who actually had his students look at MRIs and sort of evaluate what happens to people's brains when they experience certain emotions. Again, lots of history lessons about previous presidential elections, lessons for young children in third grade, for instance, about checks and balances and the fact that Trump, you know, won't be a dictator and he can't come in and automatically enact all of these things that he's been talking about on the campaign trail.
How is Harry Potter used?
Right. That was interesting. I spoke with a reading specialist in San Jose, and she works with children who are a few years behind in reading. And so she pulled out a quote by Dumbledore, who is sort of Harry's mentor, about light versus dark and good versus evil. And asked her students to sort of compare that to the election. Now, that arguably brings in some bias. I think that in this case, Trump was sort of viewed as the darkness and maybe Clinton as the light. I'm not sure that lesson would sort of fly in Kentucky, for instance, but it seemed to go over well in San Jose.
One of the sources that was mentioned in your article and also mentioned here by the United Educators of San Francisco was a Huffington Post article about how to talk to students. I think it was entitled something along the lines of, you know, what do we tell the children? In the sense that they're going to, you know, an article as a guide also kind of gives a sense, too, that teachers are really looking for some kinds of curriculum, some kinds of standards that they can, you know, adhere to.
Right. I think that's true. And I think that the timing on that article was critical. It went up sort of right as the election results were breaking. And I think that students teachers were waking up to the results and sort of wondering how they were going to approach it and getting online. And that article just was widely shared on social networks and via email. And a lot of teachers thought it was a good guidepost for how to approach the election with students.
David Morin, as someone who works in civics education, this sounds like a big opportunity to reinvent civics education, or at least, you know, make a big contribution to it.
It is. And, you know, in some ways, it's gratifying to see that in many ways the media and the country is waking up to the importance of civics education in a way that hasn't been before. And in fact, we, in anticipation of the election, knowing regardless of the results, we wanted to be able to provide some very tangible lesson plans for teachers to just deal with the emotions that came out of this election, regardless of who you supported. So we actually put together a curriculum for teachers and students to use to foster conversation, but to really ground this in a local conversation.
What do you mean by a local conversation?
So as an organization, we really focus on local politics. That's where we place a strong emphasis insofar as where we know people can affect the biggest change. So it's focused on local and it's focused on action-oriented education. And so we launched beyondtheballot2016.org, and it has a curriculum with both a toolkit of very actionable steps people can take to get more civically engaged, and then there's also two very specific lesson plans that teachers can use in their classrooms.
And so by focusing on the local, are you saying that it gives students and teachers a greater sense of agency?
That's exactly right. You know, what we know is that if you think about the fact that there are nearly 500,000 elected officials in this country, the fact is that the school board member, the city councilor, the supervisor in San Francisco, those folks often have greater impact on their daily lives than, say, who's running for president. And so we really want to ground our students in understanding and appreciating that their greatest sense of agency is in local politics.
I'm joined now by Maddie Johnson. She's a ninth grader at Sacred Heart Cathedral Preparatory in San Francisco. She participated in an after-school rally at City Hall last week. Hi, Maddie. How are you?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for being here. So tell me, first start by telling me how you've been feeling since election night.
So it was extremely disheartening for me to see people make such an extreme choice and abandon all rational thinking because their need for change is so great. It's upsetting, especially that people voted for one candidate because they didn't agree with the other. And the aftershocks of the election have been terrifying, honestly, the harassment of minorities and the fear that women will lose their reproductive rights.
Have you seen this, at your school in terms of harassment or anything like that?
At my school, we are mainly Democratic, but we do our best to respect everyone's opinion, whether that be voting for Hillary or Donald.
Why did you rally? What did that do for you to be able to join a City Hall rally?
So I was for sure not protesting a peaceful transition of power. I think it was a show of support for equality, and to show solidarity with everyone who will be affected by our president-elect's proposed policies.
And how did it feel, though, to you know, join a protest? Was that, you know, cathartic for you? Did you feel like, you know, did you like being able to be around other people who you felt shared your views? I'm just wondering, you know, what it did for you.
I thought it was incredibly empowering to stand with people of the same opinion who are so passionate for what they believe in.
What's the mood in your school like now? Are things starting to ease a little bit, or is there still a lot of tension and anxiety?
I think things are definitely starting to simmer down. I have noticed there was another small rally on Monday, but people are starting to realize that they need to focus on local government and that, unfortunately, there's nothing that we can do to change the results of this election.
Do you have friends who are Trump supporters by any chance?
I do, actually. I have several friends who, they are conservative, but they're unsure whether or not they would have voted for Donald.
If they could have voted, they're unsure of whether or not they would have.
Yes, but they're definitely conservative and they dislike Hillary.
And how are the conversations with them, how have they been for you?
It's frustrating that they don't share my opinion, but I respect that they have their own thoughts, and I respect that where they're coming from and their grievances are legitimate.
And what was your school's position on protests?
So my school had a protest during lunch on the corner of Goff and Ellis, and we were encouraged to go after school to City Hall to join into the rally, but it was not supported that we walk out of school because that does not benefit anyone.
Well, Maddie Johnson, I really appreciate you talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, best of luck to you. Maddie Johnson, a ninth grader at Sacred Heart Cathedral Prep in San Francisco, who participated in an after-school rally at City Hall last week. Emily Dury, how are schools dealing with protests across the country, particularly red state schools?
Right. It's an interesting question. I don't think there are as many protests in red states, but just from the schools that I've spoken with, and I was in a school in Washington, D.C. yesterday that had hundreds of kids walk out for a protest on Wednesday. They were saying that they supported the students in terms of their engagement with the election, but they didn't want them walking out of class and that it would be an unexcused absence, and that they didn't think that going during school hours was the best way to handle the situation.
We talk more with Emily Dury after the break. She's senior associate editor covering education at The Atlantic, who's working on a series of stories related to how schools are handling the post-election environment. We're also joined by David Morin. He's Bay Area Executive Director of Generation Citizen, which works to provide civics education. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation with your thoughts. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. We hear from you as well after the break. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. In today for Michael Krasny, we're talking about how Bay Area schools are navigating the range of emotions among their students and their faculty after the election of Donald Trump as president, and how they're addressing racist incidents that occur in their schools. We also want to hear from you, our listeners. If you have school-age children, what are they telling you about conversations happening at school? What do you think the schools here are doing well? What do you think they could be doing better? I'd also like to note that we have a link to our guest Emily Dury's Atlantic article on our website, kqed.org/forum. She is the senior associate editor covering education at The Atlantic and has been talking with dozens of teachers across the country and school officials. We were also joined by David Morin. He is Bay Area Executive Director of Generation Citizen, which provides youth with action civics education to enable them to participate in American democracy. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum at kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Let's hear what our listeners have to say. Let's go to Fred in San Francisco. Hi, Fred.
Hi. I have a comment. I think that the school, you know, should not be involved in injecting political discourse into curriculum and into extracurricular activities. I think the schools you know, have undue influence on children, and, you know, they may appear to be taking sides. And, you know, I think the responsibility should rest more on, you know, parents and, you know, the influences in the children's lives, and that, you know, we could be making a big mistake by using the education system to influence the way students think about the results of the election and what types of actions that they may take as a result of that. So I'll take my comments off, take any responses off air.
Fred, thanks. Let me get a comment, actually, from David Morin. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I think Fred brings up the concern that some people have that the teachers might have an influence on their children in ways that they wouldn't prefer, and injecting values that are in opposition to their family values. I think there's a really important distinction between political discourse, as Fred puts it, but what I think he was referring more to is really partisanship. And I think it's important that that teachers really understand and appreciate the difference between those. And I would wholeheartedly disagree that I think political discourse is crucial in our classrooms, but I think partisanship can be left at the door. So I think distinguishing between those two things is really important. We definitely agree that we do not advocate for any one party or another, but what we absolutely champion is the idea that political discourse must be a foundational part of a child's education. And I think the point that he brought up about leaving that to parents, you know, personally, I don't think that that's an either-or conversation. I think it's both and. I think this country has a responsibility both in the classroom and at home to educate our youth, and maybe the partisan conversations can be had around the dinner table, but nonpartisan political conversations can absolutely and should be had in the classrooms.
Well, Noel comments, we need to have discussions in the classroom, not patriotic cheerleading. When history classes are robbed of controversy, students are bored. Students need to learn to listen to varying viewpoints and learn how to apply critical thinking skills.
That's exactly right. And just getting back to the idea of local, for us, the way that we make politics not boring for students is that we ask them to talk about issues that are impacting their daily lives. So really anchoring them in local issues is for us one way that we find our students find politics actually quite engaging when they get to be the decision makers of the issues that they tackle.
Well, then do you disagree, David Morin, with the email that was circulated by the San Francisco Teachers Union that had a lesson plan by a teacher who felt it was necessary to call out Donald Trump as a racist and sexist man?
You know, I think that teaching values that everybody can agree on is important. I think that tying them to a specific party is a delicate balance. I think that, you know, like Maddie said, that the students who went out and protested, hopefully they weren't protesting a peaceful democratic election so much as they were protesting values that flew in the face of equality and inclusion.
Emily Dury, how are you hearing teachers respond to this? There have been conversations about how to, you know, foster positive dialogue and open dialogue among students, but how not to ignore that this was an extraordinary campaign and an extraordinary candidate at this point who will occupy the White House.
Right. I think it's an important question and a complicated question. And I spoke with a teacher outside of New Orleans at a charter school, and her school leadership asked her not to address the election at all. She said, if you must talk politics, talk about the student council election. But that teacher said that that was impossible because she had students coming in, particularly in the days immediately after the election, saying, you know, I'm going to be deported, or they were crying. And there's no way to teach a kid science or math if they're that upset. And so teachers in some cases have to address the election to move on to their regular curriculum. And that particular teacher talked about some of Trump's stances and how she planned to keep her students safe, and then pivoted to a conversation about checks and balances. And I know I've said that multiple times, but that does seem to be how a lot of teachers approached the election, because it was factual. And then other teachers were also talking about how students get news, how they read news, how they figure out what is accurate. And that's an important life skill.
So that's another opportunity in terms of media literacy, you're saying, and understanding how to navigate all the noise.
Exactly. And I think we saw a lot of fake articles go around Facebook, for instance, and, you know, even adults being swayed by them. And I think that teachers see this as a real opportunity to educate children about how to figure out what's real and what's not.
Can you put in context how unusual or not unusual the reaction is that you're hearing about across the country? Because we did see protests after Obama's election, Bush's election. Is this different? Is this more elevated?
I think that this is elevated. I think that the campaign on both sides was, it was divisive. The rhetoric was often very negative. And I spoke with students in high school who were really sort of discouraged, and they would say things like, why are they so mean to each other? But I do think that there were protests, like you said, after Obama's election and after Bush's election. And this isn't entirely new. It feels new for these students because many of them weren't born or were very young for those earlier elections. So it feels new for them. But I think that's where teachers can come in and say, look, you know, these elections happen every 4 years, every 8 years, and protests happen, and add some history and some context.
Yes, but you have had teachers tell you that this is an unusually extreme set of reactions they're seeing compared to past
elections.
Yes,
and I think
elections.
That is important. And I think that that is important to acknowledge. I think that some of this is extreme. And we heard some rhetoric on the campaign trail, about building the wall or banning Muslims or and that wasn't necessarily normal. I don't think that we can ignore some of the rhetoric that kids were hearing, and kids were legitimately scared where maybe they weren't in previous election cycles.
Well, let's hear from more of our listeners. John in Palo Alto. Hi, John.
Hi, that's not my real name, and that leads into my comment. There is a climate of fear in this country, and especially in the Bay Area, and intimidation of people whose views do not line up with those in the majority. And it's ironically very similar to what we saw when we lived in a so-called red state, where it was the other way. But I cannot say anything that would dispute the consensus that Trump is racist and we're all headed to ruin, which is totally silly. It's not supported by the evidence.
John,
that climate of fear is affecting our kids, number one. Number two, I'd like to respond to the comment about critical thinking. I'm all on board with that. We teach our kids critical thinking outside of the school. I actually tutor kids in that. And what is going on now with the president and Trump is very clear.
John, I'm sorry. I think the line, we're having trouble with your line, but I think we get your point. And I want to add a couple of other comments that we're getting. Alex comments, I saw on Cron 4 this morning that schools in the Bay Area are actually offering lesson plans that include teaching kids that Trump is a racist and sexist. Really? I'm so sick and sad hearing of all of these kids who are scared and frightened about Trump becoming the president. Why are you getting your young children involved in adult politics? Trump writes, white Trump supporters are getting bullied and assaulted all over the Bay Area and not a mention of it. My son's school's bathroom had graffiti saying, kill all whites. Where's reporting of that? This show is so biased, it's laughable. We did, at the top of the show, talk about the student at Woodside High School who was attacked for voicing Trump, pro-Trump views. Emily Dury, I'm wondering, you know, there have been racist incidents at schools even prior to Trump's election. Do you know, are you hearing evidence that there is, in fact, a surge of racist incidents post his election, or are we seeing, or are we just, you know, much more focused on them and reporting them more?
So I have heard that there has been an increase. I don't have hard data on that, but anecdotally, I am hearing that. And I'm hearing about it in places like Los Angeles and San Diego and, all over the country. But I do agree to speak to the previous caller's point. I spoke with a kid in Kentucky who said that he supported Trump but felt nervous talking about it, and that his female classmates, for instance, were very upset with him. Or a teacher in Denver said that she had a few kids who supported Trump and were almost whispering it. They were sort of nervous about coming forward and saying they supported Trump. And I think it is a real – there's real tension between not ostracizing those kids but also making kids who are scared feel safe. And it's a balance that's hard to strike.
And there's also a real tension in trying to call out racism or sexism for what it is, right, versus trying to make sure that you have a balanced perspective on an incoming president.
Right, exactly.
And let's hear from more of our listeners. Let's go to Catherine in Lafayette. Hi, Catherine.
Hi there.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay, so I attend St. Mary's College of California, and it's a Catholic institute, and our campus has definitely been divided in the face of the election, and Trump supporters have acted adversely to some of the solidarity protests and sit-ins that we've had on campus. And honestly, it's been really frustrating because I obviously don't think that Trump supporters are all racist or homophobic or sexist. I really don't. But I do think that Trump supporters do need to acknowledge, especially on my Catholic campus, that as a result of their vote, undocumented students and queer students like myself simply don't feel safe in our country anymore. And so it's been really frustrating to be dealing with that divisive environment and to also be balancing all of this on top of being a college student. It's just, it's a very contentious environment, and I'm anxious to see where it's all headed.
Well, Catherine, thanks for sharing that, and sorry to hear that's what you're going through. Let's hear next from Jerry in Sebastopol. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah. My comment is the fact that we're teaching our children about history and civics, and they're learning about what went on in the past. And the person that was elected ran on the same rhetoric and policies that Hitler ran on. So these people have a right to be scared. I'm part of the LGBT community, and we have suffered an instantaneous uptick in verbal assaults at this point. So these people, these children, we really do need to support them in their protests. I'm part of the generation that did something the world never did before. We stopped the war through popular dissent. And with what this person's run on and what his plans on, we need to stop his policies because they are fascist.
Well, Jerry, thanks for registering your opinion. Alex writes, the climate of divisiveness is not advanced by the man Donald Trump. It's completely perpetuated and exacerbated by the fear-mongering media moguls manipulating the masses. Mashud writes, as a Pakistani Muslim American parent of three children aged 8 through 14, I'm deeply concerned about the toxic environment that Mr. Trump has created. My youngest daughter asked me, will Donald Trump send all 4 million Muslims out of the country now? What am I supposed to say to her? David Morin, do you have any thoughts?
You know, I was reflecting on something that that the previous caller had said, so impassioned by where we find ourselves today, which is that he said, you know, we're teaching our kids civics and we need to support them. And I wholeheartedly agree that we need to absolutely support our youth. And to my mind, they're most important in this conversation. But I absolutely have to disagree, unfortunately, that we actually aren't teaching our kids civics. And in fact, this is how we find ourselves in so much of the situation that we're in. I mean, civics education has really been gutted from so much of our curriculum across the country. We have found that if it's being taught at all, it's still grounded in that sort of old textbook-based, you know, rote memorization that really lacks in the relevance to a student's daily life. And so a lot of our students and even our educators are feeling just uninformed about how to navigate through democracy.
Again, we're talking with David Morin, Bay Area Executive Director of Generation Citizen, which provides youth with action civics education. And we're talking with Emily Dury, Senior Associate Editor covering education at The Atlantic. We're joined now by Alyssa Hoy. She's a third grade teacher at Bayview Elementary School in San Pablo. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. So I understand that you have been doing restorative circles in your class since the election. What are those and what are they trying to accomplish?
Well, restorative circles are basically conversations that we have together as a class, and they're really to build community. We use them to learn to respect each other's thoughts and feelings, and also be able to share one another's feelings about whatever situation or circumstance we're going through. And this particular one was about the election, so we knew there was going to be, you know, some students that were feeling sad, and then, of course, there were going to be some students that were feeling okay and others that didn't really have feelings. But it was really just to be able to come together as a community, as a class, and talk about, well, what's one person feeling, and I need to listen to them and accept that they are feeling some way, and how can we come together to really be there for them.
And tell me about your student body. Your classroom, actually. You can keep it.
We have a really diverse class. I have students that are, of course, African-American, Hispanics, Latinos, students from Vietnam and Fiji. So we have a very diverse class, and it really provides a really great conversation for everybody, because we come from different places and we come from different cultures and different families. So it actually provides a very colorful conversation and different perspectives that I think everybody kind of is able to come together and really take in that we're not all the same, but we do have similar views, and we can appreciate each other even with our differences.
What was the hardest question or comment you heard?
That was actually a few months ago. I was asked a question from one of my students. When Donald Trump becomes president, when will my family get deported? And that was really hard for me to hear because I didn't know how to answer it. It was a question that I really was kind of at a point where I just didn't know what to say, because, of course, I want to be there and say that's not going to happen. But, you know, there's also that thing that I don't really know if that's going to happen or not. So it just, that one really has stuck with me, that question. And I really struggle to, I give as much comfort to my students as I can, without, you know, making promises that obviously I'm not in charge of keeping or able to keep.
Did you share how you voted with your kids?
This time I did. I actually, I was very clear with my students that my beliefs were not aligned with what Trump was saying, especially regarding racism and sexism, and that I respect everybody. So because of the divisive things that he was saying that was trying to divide me and my students, I did tell them, I said, I am going to vote for this person and I'm not voting for this other person. And I did that because they've been seeing things on TV, and I wanted them to know I was with them.
Did you did they actually have the assumption that you were going to vote for Trump? I think you said a couple of students had that assumption.
Last year I did. So during the primaries, a couple of my students kind of hinted at the fact that I might be voting for Trump, or they would ask me in a certain way that made it seem like maybe they were worried that I was going to.
I see.
So, yeah, that came up last year in my other class. So before, with all of the things that were going on in the primaries, some of my students did kind of assume that I might be voting for him. And that was one of the times when I said I'm not, because I wanted them to know I'm on their side, and that because I can't teach my students to be kind if I don't believe in it myself.
Well, Helen writes, there's an opportunity for teachers to drill down in a constructive and kind way. Why do you like Hillary or Donald? In other words, to teach an examination of why they think or feel what they do. That is relatively objective. Did you try that, Alyssa Hoy?
I did. I was, you know, this year we learned a lot about both candidates and before the elections, and we really took the time to read articles about each person, so they actually were able to make up their own choices. But I think that for them it's hard to be objective when they're seeing the things and hearing the things that they do on TV and the news at home. So I think for them it was difficult to kind of be objective themselves, because they know that being kind is something that we all do and we all should be. So I think when they would hear things that Trump would say, it would be, to them, they would not appreciate it. And I think also that comes from how their parents are feeling too about the elections. And so
Yes.
We did try, though. We did try to be objective, and we definitely learned about both candidates. And I said that it was important to, you know, to rise above and to still learn that, you know, regardless of what Trump says, we still need to be kind about him. And we still need to learn that it's okay to vote for him, and it's okay to believe in some of the things he believes in.
Alyssa
so
Hoy.
We did.
Yeah, third grade teacher at Bayview Elementary School in San Pablo. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
And let's go to more of your calls. Ramsey in Oakland. Hi, Ramsey.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I also want to thank all the parents and educators who are approaching this with empathy and with rationality, which is, you know, very valuable. My comment is simply to reinforce what's been said by several guests and callers already, and that is that I think that the level of education for civics and history is very poor, through no fault of the educators themselves, but the curriculum. I think that it focuses on, as one person said, it, patriotic cheerleading, talk about cherry trees and founding fathers, and, you know, I don't see any value in it as opposed to the very relevant and tumultuous events which happened just one generation ago, which are still shaping American society today. That's left till like the last week of class, and, you know, usually glossed over. And usually when students are learning for the first time about civics, history, policy, tax code, insurance, justice system, it's when they're thrown into it. And that's just not the way you raise an informed civilization or society. Hmm. I'll take my comments off the air.
Well, Ramsey, thanks for saying that. I appreciate it. Let me try to get Megan from Piedmont in here. Hi, Megan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I'm a newly retired elementary school teacher, and I think it's incredibly important that teachers go ahead and not treat this as a normal election. It's a great teachable moment, and as you're a third-grade teacher, really, shared, it's a complex one to navigate in a classroom. But one of my main concerns, if teachers gloss over it, we're really giving students a silent message that some of the horrible, you know, rhetoric that Trump espoused is acceptable. And I know teachers work very hard to, you know, make sure students know that being kind to each other, being respectful of diverse people are important qualities and ones that we want them to grow up. To grow up with.
Megan, thanks for the point. I want to ask you, David Morin, in thinking about civics education, actionable civics education, and trying to make it relevant to our times and beyond the ballot, as you say, is there a conversation about incorporating defining racism and sexism, not so much saying that this was or wasn't, but defining what it is for students in the context of, you know, this particular election so that students can decide for themselves whether the rhetoric they're hearing qualifies?
So that's not part of our curriculum, but we absolutely encourage educators to embed that into the conversation. We really are talking about kind of action-oriented policy change. And so we want the students to understand what they can actually do about it. I'd love to echo what the last caller said about, you know, this election offering so many teachable moments. You know, we'd love to have students start thinking about how does voter turnout affect our elections, and have them start to connect the dots between the fact that who did and didn't vote and why not, and have them start grounding their conversation in those topics. You know, tying things to historical context of where times like this happened before, talking about balance of power. So, you know, it's one thing, as the previous caller before that said, about, you know, we've been grounded so much in fact memorization, just civic knowledge. But for us, it's also about civic skills and also civic disposition and cultivating those two pieces as well.
Let's hear from Mohammed in San Francisco. Hi, Mohammed.
Call. I have a 9-year-old daughter, and she came from Afghanistan a few months ago. And I, you know, first of all, I give her like a special impression as to like how teachers are nice and the whole system here is polite and so on. But what happened a few days, I was watching a video, and Donald Trump, the president of the United States, was talking, and he used, the video was about his comment about women, the inappropriate word that he used. And my daughter, who is learning English, and asked me immediately about that word and said, what does it mean that? And I was in shock, and I couldn't explain that. And immediately, I just stood up, and I had a lot of questions of myself, and that was a hard situation, and it was a kind of moral dilemma, for me. What should I do in this circumstances?
Well,
there might be many other immigrants who are trying to teach their kids, from the beginning, and it's really a hard situation.
Thanks, Mohammed. I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're actually coming up to the end of the hour, but there is a resource that I was referred to, which was one put out by Common Sense Media. And Emily Duray, I wonder quickly if you have any resources as well that you can recommend.
Not really resources to recommend, but I think that teachers can go to their school leadership. They can ask how to address it. Parents can talk to teachers, because I think kids are talking about these issues on the playground, and if they can talk about them in class with an adult in some kind of structured environment, that seems to be best.
Emily Duray with The Atlantic, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
And thanks to David Morin, Bay Area Executive Director of Generation Citizen.
Thanks so much.
And thanks to Chris Funk, Maddie Johnson, and Alyssa Hoy, who joined us at the top during this hour. I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Thanks to our listeners. Thank you for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.